Cool. Yeah, thanks for having me back here. So I realize the title is sort of a mouthful, and I'll try my best to unpack it as we go along. So the main idea of the talk is to explore relationships between entanglement entropy and energy, and in particular to sort of understand at a deeper level the quantum null energy condition for quantum field theories. But before jumping right into quantum field theory and all of the baggage that goes with that, I just wanted to remind you about the situation in classical field theory that we're all, more or less happy with. So in classical field theory, the energy density is always bounded from below thanks to the null energy condition, which, just says that the null-null component of the stress tensor is always positive. And the null energy condition is actually probably one of the most important energy conditions in classical field theory because it's used in black hole thermodynamics and general relativity in very important ways. So if you want to prove the singularity theorems, the focusing theorem, or Hawking's area theorem, they all require the null energy condition. And since black hole thermodynamics is actually really important, and we've learned that there are important relationships between black hole thermodynamics and quantum field theory, it's of course important to understand what the analog of the null energy condition is in quantum field theory. Now, you might be familiar with the statement that in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory, you can't have a local energy density that's positive. You can't have a positive energy condition for any local stress tensor. And it's essentially just because of quantum fluctuations in arbitrary states if you try to look at the energy density at a point. But if you wanted to, go into it in more detail, it essentially follows from the separating property of the vacuum when if you think about quantum field theory more from an algebraic point of view. And there's some really nice notes on this by Witten where you can read about all the details. But for us, the main point is just that if you want energy conditions in quantum field theory, you're going to have to give up local energy conditions. You have to look at things that are global. So you might immediately just give up and throw your hands in the air and say this is not worth it. But there are actually, oh, I guess I got cut off, but okay, that's fine. But in the past few years, we've actually learned that energy conditions are really important in quantum field theory, especially if you want to understand causality and quantum information better. So for example, in the past few years, people have figured out how to connect chaos theory, chaos bounds, entropy inequalities, and causality constraints in conformal field theories. All of these things tie together in a very nice way with energy conditions at the heart of it all. And the sort of star player in all of these things is the so-called average null energy condition. So since local energy conditions won't do, this is kind of the next best thing that you have. So instead of saying the stress tensor at a point is positive, what you say instead is that the expectation value of the stress tensor integrated along some Rindler horizon, just in regular flat space quantum field theory, is always positive. Now, this condition was sort of an open problem for a long time, but there were some beautiful proofs of it a few years ago that made use of some very interesting techniques. So Faulkner and collaborators came along and showed that this inequality is true by using monotonicity of the relative entropy. So it was a quantum information sort of approach to studying the average null energy condition. And, oh, okay, is there a way to... Yeah, I can. Okay, that's better. And Hartmann and collaborators also proved the quantum null energy condition, but using causality constraints. So you studied causality properties in quantum field theory of correlation functions and use unitarity, a sort of Euclidean version of unitarity called reflection positivity, to prove this inequality. So for us, none of these details really matter. The main point is that there are deep properties of quantum field theory, like causality, and properties of quantum information that all seem to be tied up to energy conditions. But you know, like I said, this is a non-local energy condition, and if you're very steadfast about it, you would really want to see if there's a local notion of an energy condition that you can sort of get away with in quantum field theory. It's not going to be as good as a null energy condition, but you can ask, you know, what's the next best thing even beyond that? And the answer to this is a sort of well-known, at least by now, well-known inequality. It's called the quantum null energy condition. And so I try to avoid equations as much as possible, but in this kind of talk, there are a bunch of equations that showed up anyways. And I'll do my best to unpack them, but if you have any questions about any of the things that show up, please feel free to stop me. So let me just explain what's going on here. So the setup that we're gonna have in mind for pretty much the rest of the talk is just regular flat space quantum field theory. Imagine you have a Cauchy surface and you divide that Cauchy surface in half along that dotted line. And you think about the half space that's defined that way. So I'll call that region R. And then you shoot out a Rindler horizon from whatever this half space is. And imagine taking deformations of the cut, so the dotted line, along some profile V of Y in the null direction. So the claim is that the stress tensor at a point, the expectation value of it, is always bounded from below by the second derivative of the entropy. So the entropy I'm talking about here is the von Neumann entropy coming from the reduced density matrix where you trace out the complement of this region R. So if you take that entropy, you take a functional derivative of it along some profile V of Y in the null direction, and then you take a total derivative of it again in the null direction, and I'll explain what that total derivative and all that is in a second. The claim is that the second derivative there is always bounded by the stress tensor. Okay, so this is pretty nice because on the one hand, we have an energy quantity on the left-hand side, and on the other hand, we have a information theoretic quantity on the right-hand side. Right? So this links together energy density and entanglement entropy in a very, very nice way. Now, this was sort of conjectured many years ago by Busso and collaborators. And it looks sort of like a very random inequality. You might think where it even came from. And it came from actually studying the classical focusing theorem in general relativity. So you start with a classical focusing theorem, and then you ask, so we know it's violated in quantum field theory, what might save it? So you might conjecture something called a quantum focusing conjecture, which takes into account the fact that energy can be negative at a point in quantum field theory. And if you take the limit where gravity goes away, you land on this inequality. So that's how these guys conjectured this. And then there were varying levels of proofs of it, starting with free theories and then holographic theories. And eventually a very general proof was given by Balakrishnan, Faulkner, and some others that actually very beautifully tied together both of the proofs of the average null energy condition. So it made use of both causality and properties of entanglement entropy. And it was sort of it's a crazy tour de force of defect techniques and conformal field theory and all of that, but the main idea is it connects together energy and entanglement in quantum field theory. And I kind of want to keep honing that in because the whole crux of this is, while this looks like a very deep connection, we're actually going to find that energy density and entropy variations are even more deeply connected. So let me just unpack this for you and then see if you guys have any questions. Okay. So imagine we're on this null surface, and imagine we take two variations of it. These two variations don't necessarily need to be at the same point. So you can imagine you have these two different profiles, some bump B and some bump C, two different points. So the second variation on the left side starts with a functional variation where you deform your cut by some profile V of Y like this, right? Then you have a total derivative, and the total derivative is just defined in the usual way in terms of functional variations. And because there are two different points, Y and Y prime, we can decompose this second derivative of the entropy in a very natural way. So I'm going to peel off a contact term, and then whatever is not a contact term, I'm going to call off diagonal. All I mean by that is y is not equal to y prime. Okay. So for this talk, we're really only interested in this contact piece of the second derivative of the entropy, because, and I won't show this here, but it's sort of a simple exercise. You can check that the off diagonal terms are always non-positive because of strong subadditivity. So you can take these regions A, B, and C that I've defined, play around with strong subadditivity, and you can convince yourself that the second derivative of the entropy is always non-positive if y and y prime are not at the same point. If they're not at the same point, they don't really see the energy density. So for us, really, the only interesting part of this quantum null energy condition is this local or diagonal part, which basically amounts to saying that the second derivative of the entropy, if both derivatives at the same point, is always bounded from above by the stress tensor. Okay, so that's sort of what we want to hone in on, that last. I'll just stop there to see if there are any questions before I move on, because that was probably already a mouthful.
I'm probably supposed to know this, but on the left-hand side, your team, you knew there was some kind of renormalization or something into defining that.
So you don't need to renormalize it because the infinities on both sides just cancel out.
Can you say a few words on why that's the case?
Yeah.
See them on that side.
The entropy side. Yeah. So I guess easiest way to see it is this whole inequality sort of comes from taking the second derivative of the generalized entropy, and there you just automatically start with the renormalized quantity because the G Newton renormalization of area is automatically canceling out the entropy variations, and the TVV terms comes from taking a second derivative of the area. So basically, if you take the G Newton goes to zero limit of the generalized entropy second derivative, you just land on this inequality. So the whole thing is automatically finite. But it's actually non-trivial to see that the renormalization of the right-hand side exactly matches the renormalization of the left-hand side. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions on sort of the basic motivation or setup? So the main result of this talk is very easy to state, and this is, so I'm going to spend the rest of the time trying to convince you that this is true. So I've sort of advertised everything so far as inequalities, like energy inequalities, and in particular we have this diagonal QNEC, and now I'm actually going to claim that it's an exact equality for any interacting conformal field theory that has some CFT fixed point. So in fact, the second derivative of the entropy at where both derivatives are at the same point is always equal to the stress tensor at that point, as long as you're in an interacting theory. It's important here that you're in an interacting theory. I'll talk at the very end about what happens in free theories. Free theories are ironically much more complicated than interacting theories when it comes to these entropy variations, and we'll see why later. But this saturation is not true in free theories. Just to take pause at what this means, I mean, this is a very sort of amazing relationship between entropy and energy. Like we entropy by itself is just some quantum information, theoretic quantity, and in quantum field theory, somehow it gets elevated to a new level where if you start taking derivatives of it, it's purely energetic. Like all of the interesting information theoretic aspects of it are purely non-local. If you just take this so entropy by itself is a very non-local quantity. You take a non-local quantity and then you take two local derivatives of it and suddenly it's entirely captured by the energy density at that point, which at least to me is pretty amazing. So again, this is the claim, and now I'm just gonna try to prove to you that this is true.
Does this mean in particular that any theory that flows from free field theory does not satisfy it?
It's a bit subtle. I'll look. That's actually one of the things I'll talk about at the end.
Wilson Fisher's.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, there's an order of limits issue with the replica trick versus taking a coupling to the free field limit, and whether or not. So what happens is you actually get a different term that on the right hand side that shows up only in the free limit, because of the way you take the replica, like the replica limit n goes to one, simultaneously with the coupling going to zero. It'll become clear how that works once I talk about the free theory. Okay. So let me just give you a brief outline of how it's gonna go so that you know it doesn't get too confusing. So we just talked about the Q-neck. So I'm gonna first try to motivate why you should believe me when I tell you this is true, just based on looking at a very, very simple setup of states that are very close to the vacuum. There's some nice properties that you can already prove there and sort of see this Q-neck saturation coming up. And we'll use that as a guide for how to prove this more generally. And then I'll talk about free theories and come to all the subtleties involved with that. And we'll see some very nice structures coming out of entropy variations with regards to these so-called light ray operators, which are just local operators that are integrated along the Rindler horizon. They have really nice properties in conformal field theories, and we'll see how they're tied to entropy variations. So let me jump right in. Okay, so we're gonna start with the same place as before, the half space in some flat space setup, and consider the Rindler horizon. And we're gonna consider our entangling surface to be some cut of the Rindler horizon at u equals zero, just that dotted line like before. So we have the usual definition of the modular Hamiltonian, which is just gonna be some, so the modular Hamiltonian is defined as minus the log of the reduced density matrix, where, again, we're defining the reduced density matrix to be what you get if you take a pure state and just trace out the left half space. So in general, the modular Hamiltonian is an extremely complicated operator because it's the log of the density matrix, can be very non-local. But in the particular case that we're interested in, which corresponds to some profiles of a Rindler horizon, the vacuum modular Hamiltonian, so if we take the state to be the vacuum, its expectation value in an arbitrary state has an extremely simple form. And this was proven to various orders, in particular by Cassini and collaborators. So the expectation value of the vacuum modular Hamiltonian in some state is just an integral of the stress tensor along the Rindler horizon, weighted by some boost factor D. So it's an extremely simple form, and this is already very powerful. We can use this to learn a lot about what entropy variations might look like. So let's do that. Let's see what we learn. So if you stare at this formula and you now try to take two functional variations of it with respect to the profile on the Rindler horizon, so take second derivative with respect to V at two different points, and you stare at this, you can convince yourself pretty easily that you just get the stress tensor evaluated at one of the points times a delta function. Okay. Now that's ingredient one. The second ingredient is the so-called first law for near vacuum states. So when I say near vacuum, I just mean you take a state that's equal to the vacuum plus some first order deformation away from the vacuum. And if you evaluate the entanglement entropy to first order in the state away from the vacuum, you can prove this simple relationship that the perturbed entanglement entropy about the vacuum is exactly equal to the perturbed modular Hamiltonian evaluated in that state. So this is called the first law. So in other words, if you want a slogan attached to it, basically says the linear and state piece of the entropy is just the modular Hamiltonian. So if you combine these two ingredients together, you immediately find that the second variation of the entropy in this perturbed state is equal to the stress tensor. So you already see Q-neck saturation happening for near vacuum states. So maybe this doesn't surprise you that much because near vacuum states are extremely special and a lot of the like non-local behavior of entropy is already being killed. But we can actually learn a lot already from near vacuum states if we now want to see how to prove this more generally. So any questions on that before I move on? Yeah,
so interactions weren't important here.
No, interactions weren't important here, but this is only to first order. So like this is in a free theory, it's also true that for near vacuum states, this is the case, but it won't be true for arbitrary states. Is that your question too?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. So I want to try and use this near vacuum as some sort of guide. Like, what am I supposed to do now if I want to prove it more generally? And this is a bit of a schematic, but hopefully it gives you the motivation before I jump into the horrible ugliness that is defect CFTs. So we're interested in the contact term of the contact piece of the entropy variations, right? So ultimately, what we're interested in is taking two variations that approach each other at arbitrarily short length scales. So you can sort of think about what we're doing as taking some state and zooming into some extremely small region of that state. Now, this is, again, a bit of a heuristic. This isn't really true if you're like at a precise level, but I think you'll more or less agree that if you take an arbitrary, like a nice smooth quantum state, and you zoom into an arbitrarily small patch of it, that it'll effectively look like the vacuum. Because at very small length scales, the entanglement structure of an arbitrary state in quantum field theory is dominated by the vacuum entanglement structure. So it sort of looks like the vacuum. So we want to know, like, is there a way to sort of mock up this idea that we're looking at things that effectively look like the vacuum at very small scales? And there is a nice way to do this in conformal field theory, essentially by looking at operator product expansion. So if you look at the operator product expansion of something, not really, like, we'll talk about what that something is, but there's some kind of operator product expansion in conformal field theory that you can look at, which will probe the universal behavior of entanglement entropy at these small length scales. Essentially because OPE data is universal. It doesn't care about the state that you're in. It really just cares about the fact that you're looking at some very, very small length scale. So the big question is, like, okay, what do we look at the OPE of? We're interested in studying entropy variations, which looks like an extremely like information theoretic quantity. Is there some quantity in conformal field theory whose OPE allows us to probe this? And in fact, there is. But in order to talk about it, we have to first remind ourselves how the replica trick works. So normally, when you want to compute the entanglement entropy, what you do is you compute the Rennie entropy, the trace of rho to the n, and you take a derivative with respect to n, and then you consider the non-replica limit, the limit where n goes to 1, and this gives you the entropy. So in practice, if you visualize things as sort of a pie, here's like what you do is you take your theory, which is like one slice, and then you make n copies of it. And then on this n-sheeted theory, you have an n-sheeted partition function. And then you analytically continue that n-sheeted partition function in n. And once you do the analytic continuation in n, then you can take derivatives with respect to n and take the limit as n goes to 1. And then you're happy because you can get the entropy that way. So just one thing to keep in mind is when you do this procedure of taking n copies of your theory, the entangling surface, which is at the middle of this pi, is held fixed. Like, we don't want to change the region that we're computing the entropy of. So you glue n copies holding the like entangling surface fixed. So it creates a branched cover of your original theory. There's sort of a branch cut or like a branched submanifold that you get in higher dimension about that fixed point. And while this is nice, it's not the easiest way to get a handle on the entropy itself. So instead, what we're gonna do is use the idea of like a defect. So you have this branched manifold, and you have a branched partition function on that manifold. Instead, what you can do is you can just take an orbifold of this branched manifold. And what this does is it takes you back to your original manifold, except now there's a codimension 2 defect sitting where your entangling surface. So it, you can now think of what we're basically doing is we have a CFT with a boundary. The boundary is a codimension 2 submanifold of the theory. And there's this non-local twist defect, I've called it tau, which is sitting on that entangling surface after we did this orbifold. But it's just a special example of a boundary conformal field theory. So now we can just use our regular CFT techniques that we're all happy with in the presence of this extra defect. And the defect makes our life harder, but in a way that's in control, as we'll see. Any questions on that basic sort of setup? All right. Okay, I actually made a mistake here. That sigma should just be a tau. It's just what I called tau here. It's this twist defect, so just keep that in mind. Okay, so you should really think of this defect as something which is breaking the global conformal symmetry of the theory down to some subset of the conformal group. So now what I'm allowed to do is do conformal symmetries within the defect, so that's my SOD minus 2, and then I'm allowed to do rotations about the defect. So I have two null directions around the defect, and I can do rotations around those two null directions, and then whatever internal conformal symmetries I have within the defect. Now what this does is, even if I have an operator that's in the bulk of my theory, so like away from the defect, if I bring it close to the defect, it turns into an infinite tower of operators on the defect because of this broken conformal symmetry. It's essentially just saying that if I have a boundary conformal field theory and I have some bulk operator, it induces, you know, in general, an infinite tower of excitations on that boundary, unless it's some special protected operator. Okay, so essentially, you know, schematically what's going on in this diagram is, you know, if I take two operators and I bring them close to the defect, it turns into some sum over operators on that defect. But what the special thing here is, even if you just have one operator and you bring it close to the defect, it's going to turn into some sum of operators on the defect. Okay, so unfortunately, I have to go into this in a little bit more explicit detail. So let's say we just pick light cone coordinates in Minkowski, and then we complexify the coordinates because we're going to be interested in doing analytic continuation, so we need to consider complex coordinates. So just have the usual light cone coordinates, and I'm going to use W and W bar for the complex light cone coordinates. If you're in the Lorentzian section of this complex manifold, then W bar is just what we usually call V, and W would be what we usually call U, right? Just keep that in mind. Okay. So you can work out, there's a way to work out this formula that Faulkner and collaborators do in their paper for what the bulk to defect OP is. So if I take an operator O and bring it close to the defect, then it turns into an infinite sum of defect operators, and it's given by this formula. I'm gonna put hats over operators that are defect operators just to distinguish them from the bulk operators. And also one thing which is important to note, and you'll see it coming up over and over, note that whenever I have a bulk operator, I have a sum from k equals 0 to n minus 1 of that bulk operator. And that's because the procedure that we used was an orbifold, right? So we started with this n-sheeted replica manifold and orbifolded it to get this twist defect, which means what I've done is I take an operator in my original quantum field theory and I insert n versions of it, right? One for each of the replica sheets. And then do the orbifold. You can only do orbifold if you have Zn symmetric operators. So these local operators will always show up with the Zn symmetric sum. That's all that sum. Okay, so you have this complicated looking formula. Almost none of this actually is important for you to remember. You just have to know there is a formula that you can use. And you can sort of invert this formula if what you're interested in is extracting a particular defect operator from a given bulk operator. So the way you invert this is essentially just do a residue projection. So if you're interested in a defect operator that has a particular conformal dimension and spin, it comes with a particular, you know, W and W bar. So you can just do a contour integral with the appropriate pole so that it picks up that operator. So that's what this formula is. Again, the general formula doesn't matter to us because ultimately what we're interested in are stress tensors. Any questions? Okay. So this is the one that we actually care about, and thankfully this one looks a lot nicer than that general. So now I'm going to take the stress tensor, since ultimately that's, you know, what we care about, and bring it close to the defect. And it's going to give me an infinite tower of operators. But in particular, it's going to give me a spin one operator on the defect, and that's the one that we're interested in. So that's given by this formula. It's just a contour integral of the stress tensor around the defect. Okay. This operator is called the displacement operator. Now, if you started from this and derived this formula, you wouldn't at all like care about what this operator is, just something that's given in terms of the stress tensor. But it has a separate definition that's much more geometric, which might help you appreciate why it's important and why it's called a displacement operator. So if you look at the second definition here, this comes from the diffeomorphism word identity. So basically, remember how we said the defect breaks the full conformal invariance? In particular, it breaks translation invariance because the defect is sort of a special place. And the breaking of the translation invariance in the bulk is manifested by the presence of this operator. So usually the stress tensor is conserved, but it's not conserved if you're literally on the defect, and the amount of non-conservation is given by the displacement operator. Now, you can kind of stare at this, and you have like a derivative operator acting on the stress tensor on the left-hand side equals a delta function times this operator. So you can convince yourself that what's happening here is the stress tensor has a 1 over W pole in it, 1 over W bar kind of pole. And the way you pick off the defect operator is just by doing a contour integral around that pole. And that's where that first formula fits in with this definition. So that's why these two are equivalent. So this displacement operator, again, just to emphasize, is sort of telling you how much translation invariance is broken due to the presence of the defect. And the nice thing about it is it implements shape deformations of the entropy. Because the extent to which the stress tensor is not conserved is essentially, if you remember from the definition from the variation of the action, this object, the displacement operator, is what's conjugate to taking deformations of your entangling surface. So if you deform your entangling surface a little bit, the conjugate object to that is the displacement object. So there's an algorithmic way for now computing what the second derivative of the entropy is. So if you want to take delta S, delta V twice, you just insert two displacement operators in whatever state you're in. You insert one at Y, you insert the other one at Y prime, and then you take the limit as n goes to 1 of 1 over n minus 1. So the 1 over n minus 1 comes from the replica trick, where you always take the limit as n goes to 1 at Okay, so this now gives us an idea of sort of going back to that question from before. What do we look at the OPE of? So we want to study OPEs of something in order to probe like small distance behavior. So now it's pretty clear what we do is we just take the OPE of these two displacement operators. And that will allow us to study the contact term and the second derivative of the entropy. Right? So the name of the game now is how do you find the delta function in this OPE? And can we prove that that delta function only has one term in it, which is the stress tensor? If we can do that, then we've proven that the second derivative of entropy is always equal to the stress tensor. Okay. One fact I forgot to mention. So the displacement operator happens to be a protected operator, and its dimension is just d minus 1. When I say it's protected, what I mean is, in general, when you have a replica defect, the conformal dimension of the defect operator can get anomalous corrections in N, the replica index. But the displacement operator, because it's associated to a symmetry, is protected. It doesn't get any anomalous dimension. Okay, so where is the delta? All right, so the entire crux of this argument is based on a kind of funny representation of the delta function. And it's not at all obvious, but the point is that we can take the n goes to, at the end of the day, we have to take the n goes to one limit, right? So what ends up happening is, if you stare at this boxed equation, we have a bunch of different y minus y prime powers. And if we have an operator such that, you know, these various quantities here conspire to give you the behavior up there, d minus 2 plus some anomalous dimension times n minus 1, you can check that in the limit as n goes to 1, this object is a delta function. Okay? It's not, I mean, it's not like obvious just by staring at it, but you can integrate the left-hand side and check that it always equals 1. And it blows up when y goes to 5.
So if you place d minus 2 with a bigger power, a smaller power, so you'll get 0.
Yeah. All right. So this is sort of the important point, is that there is a way of extracting a delta function just by studying what the OP coefficients and anomalous dimensions look like in an expansion around n equals 1. So in particular, if the OP coefficient, so we're going to do everything in perturbation theory around n equals 1. That's the nice thing about replica defects. So if the OP coefficient of some operator in this OPE goes like that, so it starts at n minus 1 squared, and if the anomalous dimension starts at d and then has some n minus 1 correction, then that operator will turn into a delta function in the n goes to 1. So in particular, whatever this operator is, it needs to have spin 2 and dimension d in the original theory, in the non-replica theory. So dimension d and spin 2. You can kind of already see that the stress tensor is coming up, because stress tensor is the most natural. I mean, it has dimension d and spin 2. So now we just sort of have to convince ourselves that nothing else can also satisfy these problems. That's essentially what we've reduced this proof down to. So the stress tensor, we want to see that the stress tensor is the only thing that satisfies.
What does this gamma prime show up in the limit and then goes to 1? Is it just like a coefficient that shows up?
It's the like first order correction to the... Oh, you mean how does it show up?
Is that one will depend on gamma prime is all I'm asking.
The left-hand side?
Well,
the
left
and
right
does.
Yeah,
I see what you mean. Yeah, sorry. So what ends up happening in the left-hand side is you get C prime over gamma prime, and you can check, I'll talk about it in a bit, that is always just equal to 2 pi.
Okay.
And that 2 pi is the 2 pi that shows up in the QNet. So the ratio is always independent. Any other questions? Okay. All right, so now we want to get rid of all the other possibilities. And there actually aren't too many possibilities. I mean, there's only so many ways you can come up with an operator which in the n goes to one limit has dimension d and spin 2. So to start with, I'm just going to quote a result from this other paper for what the conformal dimension of the defect operators looks like at leading order, so not even worrying about the n minus 1 correction. So it's essentially just the twist of the original bulk operator plus the spin Lj of whatever, you know, defect operator that is induced. So here's one possibility you might imagine. So there's some spin 1 conserved current in the bulk theory that induces some spin 2 operator in the defect theory. And because it's a conserved current, it saturates the unitarity bound. So it has dimension d minus 1. has dimension d minus 1 and spin 1, and Lj is spin 2. And that would give you a dimension d operator in the defect. So that would be, this would satisfy these two properties, but it has to be a conserved current, which means it's charged under some gauge symmetry, and the entropy is uncharged. So you can't have charged operators contributing to the entropy. So that anything with charge can't show up.
So why is the current charged?
It's like, no, I just mean that it will trans, I mean, it has some like non-trivial transformation under some gauge group.
Why? You want current?
Yeah, sorry, maybe I didn't understand the, yeah, if, I mean, if I have some spin one primary that's conserved. Let me come back to that. Right, maybe I didn't understand. Okay. There's a slightly more complicated example of something that can show up. So we talked about the displacement operator, but there's actually an entire family of displacement operators. So the one we talked about is the one that's associated to the stress tensor. But there's an entire family of higher spin displacement operators for like any higher spin primary that you can write down, that's like the lowest twist primary. So this is what it looks like if what in particular what we care about is a spin 2 displacement operator in the defect theory. So essentially you take some higher spin primary and you do the whole replica, you know, sum, and you take a particular projection of it and it gives you a so-called higher spin displacement operator. So this higher spin displacement operator has spin 2 in the defect theory. And we can ask if it has the correct properties in order to turn into a delta function. So just from this formula from above, the conformal dimension of this higher spin displacement operator is equal to the twist of the operator plus 2, if we're interested in spin 2, which is, of course, what we care about. And in order for this to be equal to d, the twist has to equal d minus 2. But in any CFT with a twist gap, which is what we're interested in, the twist can never equal d minus 2. Twist is always greater than d minus 2 for a CFT with a twist gap. So these operators are always going to have dimension greater than d, so they can't turn into delta functions. There is a subtlety with free theories, because in free theories, you don't have a twist gap, and you can have operators that have twist d minus 2, and that's sort of the subtlety with free theories that we'll see later. All right, so this eliminates these possibilities. And there's one more possibility which is extremely subtle. And this is the possibility that, so what we've done so far is we first sort of expand around n equals 1, and then take the OPE of these two displacement operators. But you could ask, okay, why didn't you first take the OPE, and then take the n goes to 1 limit? And you might hope that these two things commute, but they actually don't commute. And what happens is, if you first take the OP at fixed n, you get operators which are essentially infinite resummations of local defect operators. And you might worry that these weird exotic operators can also contribute in such a way that they have dimension d. And since this case is a bit more subtle, let me come back to this in like two slides. For now, just like, you know, take my word for it that they actually don't end up giving you delta functions. Well, but they're important for the free theory too. So let me put that on pause for a second. So with those eliminated, the only option left is the stress tensor. In any interacting CFT with a twist gap, the only operator that can make a delta function come up is the stress tensor, because it has dimension d and spin 2. So now, we just have to check that, you know, it has the correct properties for the OP coefficient and the conformal dimension. And the simplest way of checking this is to use another kind of word identity, so we call it another diffeomorphism word identity, which essentially just looks like this. So you have two displacement operators, you integrate one of them in the transverse directions on the entangling surface, and it's the same as just, you know, moving the entangling surface in the null direction. So that's all this equality is saying. It's like the usual word identity, but now it's in the presence of a defect. So you can just compute the left and right hand side, order n minus one, and it's a simple computation. You can just find, you know, you basically get the result that you wanted, that C is order n minus one squared, delta is order n minus d plus n minus one, and the coefficients are exactly so that the ratio of the OPE coefficient to the anomalous dimension is 2 pi. So at that point, so you know, if you were happy with that, then you would believe that the QNEC is saturated. So that is basically argued that S double prime is always equal to the stress tensor. But this is up to the subtlety about these non-local defect operators, which actually end up being a lot more interesting than they sound. So in order to fully convince you, I have to talk about this. So let me just, I'm going to skip a lot of the computational details because they're absolutely terrible. So basically, the idea is just you take the OPE of two displacement operators and you want to study its spectrum. One way to study the spectrum of the d plus OPE is to just compute the four-point function in the vacuum. So you can compute the four-point function of displacement operators. We have four of them. And expand around n equals 1. And the leading term in the n equals 1 expansion is given by this four-point function of ANEC operators. The stress tensor contribution shows up at higher order in n minus 1. But this is the leading contribution. So the E is a half ANEC operator, so it's just integrated from 0 to infinity. And the E tilde is a full ANEC operator. It's integrated from minus infinity to infinity. Okay, so now basically we're at this point where we're like, okay, we have this four-point function of ANEC operators that's contained in the OPE of these displacement operators. What does that mean? How do you get a handle on this? So this was a problem that was actually studied a long time ago by Hoffman and Maldacena when they were looking at conformal collider physics, and it was revisited recently by David Simmons Duffin and some others. So these null energy, these ANEC operators, which are like a special case of these so-called light ray operators, have really nice OPE properties. They're non-local operators, but you can just compute their OPE. And the OPE of these ANEC operators has this particular form. So again, the details don't really matter to us. The sum over sum operators, these operators are non-local because they correspond to So what you do is you take an even spin operator and you analytically continue its spin down to spin 3. So the process of analytically continuing it down to spin 3 turns it into a non-local operator. When I say non-local, what I mean is it's like two integrals of some local operator in the null direction. There's a nice theorem you can prove in representation theory that operators that don't have even spin in conformal field theory are non-local in this sense. So you get an OPE of these non-local operators that have spin 3. And this gives us an idea of what these possible non-local defect operators could be. So we don't quite understand what they are exactly in the defect language. But whatever they are, in the original theory, they turn into these J equals 3 light ray operators. So that shows us that entropy variations have some exotic behavior once you start taking the n goes to one limit. They're not just nicely captured by a bunch of local operators. For our purposes, the main important thing is, again, if you have a twist gap, then the twist of these operators is always greater than d minus 2. So they're not going to turn into any delta functions. This is something that you have complete control over because you can just study what these operators are in a conformal field theory. Okay, so that's one piece of evidence that some exotic kind of operator does show up in the displacement operator OPE, but doesn't turn into a delta function. It's a bit baroque, but let me give you a slightly more intuitive calculation that also gives evidence that these operators show up. So again, we're gonna consider near vacuum states in an arbitrary theory. So I just have some state psi, and then I'm gonna expand it around the vacuum. I'm gonna imagine that this state is created from some local operator acting on the vacuum. And I'm gonna compute the second derivative of the relative entropy, the order epsilon squared. And if you do that, you get a very similar looking formula to what we had before. So you have some integral over S, you have two of these average null energy operators evaluated in the state created by O, and then you have some modular flow. So you have a modular Hamiltonian, you do some modular flow with the vacuum modular Hamiltonian. So we see again that the OPE of these ANEC operators is showing up in derivatives of the entropy. This is a direct calculation. So like I haven't used any defect CFT stuff here. I've just done regular resolvent trick perturbation theory for the entropy. This is not something I understand really well yet, at least. Why entropy variations seem to land you exactly on these non-local light ray operators that people found when they studied conformal colliders. So there's some kind of deep relationship between energy correlators and entropy variations. And while this is for near vacuum states, presumably this is true even more generally. Like maybe there's some sense in which entropy variations are always energetic and the non-local like nature of the entanglement is purely captured by these non-local light ray operators. And to that effect, now let's say you're in a free theory. So in a free theory, the unitarity bound can be saturated. And in this case, you can show that these two light ray operators, their OPE actually acquires a contact term. So on top of the stress tensor, you actually get a second contribution. That second contribution is whatever this evaluates to. And so you get stress tensor plus a extra contribution from this spin 3 operator. And if you compute it in free theories, it reproduces exactly the answer that these guys found in the free theory case where they did some totally different calculation. But we're like uncovering the free theory contribution starting from the defect. So someone asked earlier about what happens if you actually consider weakly interacting theory, or like a limit towards a free theory. So let me call this like non-saturation term in the free theory Q. So the first question that might come to your mind is, how did Q just disappear from the delta function as soon as I turn on an interaction, right? So in a free theory, I've just told you that there's this extra delta function term. Now I'm just gonna turn on some small interaction, lambda, and suddenly, because it's an interacting theory, the Q term is supposed to just go away. So this is especially important if you consider super Yang Mills, where there's a continuous family of CFTs that just goes down to some free fixed point. So essentially what happens, although again, the details aren't like exactly worked out, is this Q is computed from this spin 3 light ray operator. And the dimension of the spin 3 light ray operator is not protected under deformations of the theory. So what ends up happening is if you turn on a deformation of the theory, this light ray operator picks up an anomalous dimension in lambda. Lambda is like whatever the coupling is. And there's a representation of the delta function that earlier we wrote in terms of n, but there's a more complicated combination that involves both n and lambda. And what ends up happening is if you take the limit as lambda goes to zero, holding n fixed, you don't get a delta function. If you take the limit as lambda goes to, as n goes to one and then lambda goes to zero, then you end up picking up a delta function and that's how you like recover the delta function in the free theory, even if it isn't there in the interacting theory. So it's an order of limits between taking n to one and lambda to zero that reproduces a delta function in the free theory, even if it's not there in the interacting. So it sort of gets smeared out by the anomalous dimension. This doesn't happen for the stress tensor because the stress tensor is protected under deformations of the theory. It doesn't get anomalous. So let me just summarize before telling you about some things that I think are worth thinking about based on this whole procedure. So what we've basically done is use this formalism of defect CFTs, like boundary CFTs, in order to study shape deformations of entanglement entropy. So earlier, people typically studied shape deformations of entanglement entropy using perturbation theory. And while it's very nice, in order to extract the contact term, somehow the defect method seems to work the best. And using that, we argued that the second derivative of the entropy is always equal to the stress tensor. And I think this sort of just strengthens the idea that like entropy and energy are very intimately connected in quantum field theory. In a way that somehow doesn't seem to happen in like just quantum mechanics, very special to quantum field theory. And then we saw that in free theories, you got these additional terms that are related to these non-local spin 3 light ray operators, studied by Hoffman and Maldacena and others. And you know, the story is sort of, I mean, it's coherent and complete, but there are a lot of things that you can still ask based on this whole thing. So one thing which, I don't know, maybe is a little gimmicky, but might be interesting to think about, is the idea of a continuous spin QNEC. So one of the nice things about these light ray operators that was proven by David Simmons-Duffin and others is that there's actually a continuous family of them. So we saw the ANEC for spin 2. So you integrate the stress tensor and it's positive. But you can actually prove that the integral of any higher spin operator is greater than or equal to 0 for any spin whatsoever in the complex J plane, as long as J is greater than 0. And the most natural thing you can ask then is there a continuous spin quantum null energy condition? So if I do higher spin deformations instead of shape deformations, and I make the spin variable complex, can I get a QNEC out of that? You can also ask about non-null variations. So we studied null deformations because we were motivated by the null energy condition. But you probably know that in GR, there's also the dominant energy condition. And nobody really ever talks about that, at least not in quantum field theory. But using this formalism, you can just now like go ahead and compute non-null deformations of your theory, like take space-like deformations, for example. And then you can ask about quantum dominant energy condition. So is the space-like deformation of the entropy bounded by the total energy integrated over some Cauchy slice, where now you're looking at the time component of the stress tensor? And sort of the last thing, which you know, it sort of bugs me that we can't really figure this out completely, because it gets subtle very quickly, is, I mean, we talked about this non-local defect operator, and we talked about how it comes from these spin 3 light ray operators, but that's an inherently like Lorentzian description of it at n equals 1. And you can ask, what does it come from in the defect theory? You just don't ever talk about light ray operators, don't talk about Lorentzian continuation. What is it in terms of the local defect operators in the spectrum? And we had this conjecture that these spin 3 light ray operators are actually coming from an infinite resummation of higher spin displacement operators. So we talked about these entire family of higher spin displacement operators earlier. Now, there's one for each value of J. Now, so you can imagine doing an infinite sum over all J. And we have evidence that the infinite sum over J of these displacement operators turns into this non-local spin 3 light ray operator. So it's sort of like an asymptotic series, and that's like you're missing it because we worked around n equals 1 the whole time. But you know, it's pretty subtle, so it's not really clear exactly how this works, but it would be nice if that was made precise. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Time for a couple of questions.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I mean, you technically shown that it's the twist gap on whether you have free or non-free theory. Is this like one-to-one correspondence, like every theory
Wait, sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
I'm just wondering about the precise relationship between twist ganon and free theory.
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay. So it's just that in a free theory, the stress tensor isn't the only thing that shows up with twist D minus two. Like all of the higher spin currents also show up with twist D minus two. But when you go to an interacting theory, they're not conserved currents anymore, so they're not protected, and you go away from twist D minus two. So this is true for any interacting theory. If you go to the free limit, immediately you get a bunch of operators that are all twist D minus two.
Questions. I had a quick question. Do you know if this proof is valid for like a theory with gauge symmetry? Just because there's subtleties with defining entanglement in that case.
It assumes that you can factorize the Hilbert space. If you have a gauge theory, I would imagine what happens is you get additional operators that show up in the defect spectrum that sort of correspond to like you're like the like trying to do this factorization. And I don't know actually if I off the top of my head, I don't know how to argue that they wouldn't show up with like dimension D. It's not obvious that it works.
Is this the spin one current you were talking about, or is that different?
No, I think it's a little different because you could imagine. I don't know if there's a rule that says like entropy can't transform non-trivially under some representation of some like gauge group that just corresponds to like lifting the gauge symmetry at some cut, like if you want to do some extended Hilbert space type construction. I don't know how that argument.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Ben again.